Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the endarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, in other words, to address problems and issues rather than just defending positions. In 1972, a book was written that was designed to change the world. The book was called The Limits of Growth, and it was the first report issued by the Club of Rome, an organization founded by an Italian industrialist and a Scottish scientist in 1968. Well, the report warned that economic growth could not continue indefinitely because of resource depletion. The book went on to sell 30 million copies, was translated into 30 languages, and it was the best-selling environmental book in history. And here we are, nearly 50 years later, experiencing peak everything. The book was remarkably prescient, but apparently the impact hasn't been there. What happened and what can be done about it? Our guest on Wiki Politiki today is David Corton. He's a member of the Club of Rome, the organization that actually produced this, and he's devoted his work and life to bringing about what he calls an ecological civilization, the transition he calls from egonomics to economics. Here's what he writes about the epic choice that we face. Quote, "We can continue to seek marginal adjustments in the culture and institutions of the imperial civilization of violence, domination and exploitation that has put us on the path to self-extinction. Or we can transition to an ecological civilization dedicated to restoring the health of living Earth's regenerative systems while securing material sufficiency and spiritual abundance for all people." Unquote. Well, David, as the Swami would say, you're proposing a sane world. You must be crazy. But I love that phrase, material sufficiency and spiritual abundance, which is the perfect way to shift from measuring gross national product to enjoying gross national happiness. David Corton is the founder and president of the Living Economies Forum, co-founder, board member, and board chairman emeritus of Yes Magazine. He is an associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies and a full member of the Club of Rome. He worked for more than 35 years in business, academia, and international development institutions before he turned away from the establishment to become a leading critic of what he calls global suicide economy. He's the author of the international bestseller, When Corporations Rule the World, along with The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, Agenda for a New Economy from Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, and Change the Story, Change the Future, A Living Economy for a Living Earth. Welcome, David. It's great to have you.
Well, it's great to be with you, Steve. It's been a long time, and it's a very interesting continuation of our journey.
Exactly. Well, we've been co-learning for a long time here on this path, and we want this shift to take place. I want to go backward, though, to The Limits of Growth, which, as we said, was a very impactful book. got a lot of publicity and sold a lot of copies. And it offered a very helpful meme, that limits of growth, that this growing economy, and I'm sure you're going to talk more about how that all came about, has come to the point where we cannot continue to extract and not put back. So how do we make this shift? And why didn't the message get heeded initially? What's been in the way? And what might be a pathway to breakthrough?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and I'm fascinated you raise it, because it's pushed me to actually address that question more confrontedly than I have before. And the kind of simple answer is that it was at a confluence of forces. The limits to growth, the use of this computer model to essentially prove the obvious that unlimited growth on a finite planet is an oxymoron. In a way, what that book and what that model established was so simple and so obvious that you don't even need a book or a computer model. I mean, any sane human being can get it in a sentence. But it also came out at a time where there was a confluence of developments within the establishment in terms of what was happening within the discipline of economics, which was moving ever further away from reality and into a political ideology. You were also dealing with forces of wealth and the establishment that, coming out of the 1960s and all of the disruptions that were taking place there, the questioning of authority, the breaking down of gender relations, the psychedelics movement, and so forth, to the certain members of the establishment, particularly the wealthy establishment, it sort of looked like society was disintegrating, and they had to get a handle on it. And those forces came together, and of course, they had the financial power, not only to manipulate media and control media, but also to have enormous impact on academia, in terms of research grants, funding for universities, and things of that sort. And came around in terms of defending this ideology, which it's very interesting. It just struck me this morning that while their ideology centers on individualism, the situation actually brought them together as a group of wealthy patrons, essentially, to take control of the public dialogue and shift it. And the Club of Rome, by contrast, had none of those facilities and had no particular capability to mobilize academia or reshape media. And so the forces of the establishment, which were best served by this economics frame that was shifting toward ever more focus on money as the defining metric of wealth, and GDP, growing GDP, which is really all about money, and pushed the whole conversation in exactly the wrong direction. And it's interesting that since then, we've been having a revolution in science, which has moved further and further beyond this purely mechanistic view of reality to a recognition of the nature of life, of the distinctive nature of life and living beings that is essential to our well-being as humans. So we've got all of these forces now coming together, but still our the kind of dominant control of our of our mental frame, the underlying story, or another way of putting it, the maps by which we make our choices, our collective choices as a species, are controlled by the forces that led us away from the fundamental simple truth of the limits to growth. And that's what we're caught up in right now. And the coronavirus has sort of awakened us a lot. It's kind of brought a stop to much of the economy. Science is telling us that if we don't fundamentally change the way we relate to Earth over the next 10 years, at least get started on that, reframe our objectives, we're going to be beyond the point of no return. So this is a very decisive moment, and the conversation we're having here is exactly the conversation that we need to take forward into humanity.
You know, it reminds me of that old Henny Youngman joke. Henny Youngman says, I went to the doctor gave me 6 months to live. I told him I couldn't pay my bill, he gave me another 6 months. So
I love it.
so we keep pushing this marker down the road, and we're coming to the point, I've heard people talk about, sperm counts in men are getting so low that, in 30 years, it's going to be zero. We're up against all of these things. And, I guess when you're looking at the floodwaters are coming right here, we just got the alert. Everybody grab a sandbag and we're going to do what we can do. And then all of a sudden, everybody gets mobilized against a clear and present danger. But when the danger is abstractified as it has been, and so many people have tried to make it tangible, and over the past number of years, the fossil fuel companies have been using their propaganda arm to fight against the climate change narrative and all of that. So as you had pointed out, the people who are in control of the mass media until now have had these interests of this ongoing establishment financial oligarchy, and nobody has been able to change that narrative enough that enough people can begin to relate to, we really need to do something very different. And then the question remains, what level of physical disaster is it going to take before those who do have the money and power recognize that, as the Swami has said, if we lose the earth, there goes the GDP, that nobody is going to be able to survive. Even those lucky ones who will be able to escape to Mars, you must be looking at the situation over a past number of years and noticing all of these times when, we could have made the change here, we could have made the change here, and now here we are down the line and up the creek. What is it that gives you an indicator of hope that somehow the shift is going to be made?
Well, I think it's interesting that the coronavirus has essentially hit everybody, so it's gotten attention. Mm-hmm. There's also the fact that it's interesting, Steve. I mean, both of us happen to be among the fortunate few who are getting through all of this reasonably well, and our lives are reasonably secure and have been. But that's actually not true for the majority of the world's people. So we've got huge numbers of people who actually recognize that the current system is not working, and that there's a huge area in which it could get better, which is so different from our experience, where you know, when I look at this future, I have to ask myself, am I, you know, what am I willing to let go of that I have now? Now, this gets you into part of the transformation and vision that can hopefully help bring us together. It's the fact that we are faced with an imperative to change that is essential to our very survival. At the same time, if you begin to frame the possibilities of what our future world could be, you begin to see that it, in fact, could be better for everyone. Now, I don't know if you've had much experience with billionaires. I haven't had all that much experience, but enough to realize that while it looks like billionaires have all the advantages, in some ways it has to be a living hell. It is, in a way, the ultimate dehumanization, because all of your time is focused on your money, not your living. And everyone who is approaching you not because they care about you as an individual or enjoy your company or whatever. They are approaching it because they want a piece of your money. That's going to be a terrible experience.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, the system that we're in is, in fact, dehumanizing us all. So if we begin to look deeper at what does it mean to be human and what is it that gives us our true human satisfaction, we begin to realize, wow, that would be a very different world in which we're not maximizing our consumption, but we are, in fact, you know, meeting, I mean, we do have absolutely essential material needs. We, you know, starting with the air we breathe, and we need fresh water to drink, and we need healthy food and so forth, and a place to live. Those can all be provided in reasonably straightforward ways if we actually organize ourselves around those outcomes, and those outcomes for everyone. And then with that as our base, we can focus our attention on what are the things, the relationships of love and caring, the sense of being truly productive and useful in service to our neighbors, to our our pets, the animals, even the vegetables in our garden. I think my wife's greatest satisfaction is going over to a local community garden next to where we live called the Pea Patch. It's got, a couple of tiny, five now, I think 4x4 squares where, she's tending various fruits and so forth that we then add to our diet. And she gets so much pleasure from that. We get so much pleasure from taking care of our cat, each other. This is all part of recognizing that these are the satisfactions that truly reflect our humanity. It's not about, having five big houses stretched around the world that we travel to in our private jet airplane or our private yacht that looks like a looks like some major ocean-going vessel. Can you imagine trying to take care of 12 mansions connected by your yacht and your? Yeah. I mean, oh my God, what a!
It's on my to-do list that I'm looking forward to not doing that. We got to take a short break, and we'll be back with David Corton and talk more about the natural economy. Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Okay, Steve Berman, we're back with David Corton. David, here's a paradox that Bruce Lipton and I wrote about in Spontaneous Evolution, and you bring up in your work the discrepancy between what we're learning from quantum physics and the way you put it in your recent paper. You said reality is based on relationships, not particles. In other words, we're living in a quantum universe, and yet we still practice Newtonian politics, Newtonian economics, and Newtonian medicine, where we have forces that are pushing against one another rather than all of us pulling together. It's interesting. It's been more than 100 years since Einstein put forth his theory of relativity. And we are still living in a very, very linear world. How do you see this this discrepancy, and how do we bring the reality of the quantum universe into our daily life and daily practice?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I may poke it back to you in terms of. Well, one of the things that kind of fascinates me is that there are at least two major breakthroughs on the frontiers of science. One has to do with physical reality and the quantum physics insights. The other has to do with biology and our understanding of life. And you know, this came to me in my own experience, an encounter with a microbiologist named Dr. Maewon Ho.
A woman I'm familiar with her work, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, a tiny Asian woman with a huge mind, she approached me many years ago in a conference in Spain and introduced herself, and she says, I know your work, and I'm a new biologist, and I think my work has relevance to what you're doing on economics. And it's one of those extraordinary life experiences. We ended up sitting together on the plane from Spain back to London, where she lived, and on my way back to New York City. And by the time I got back to New York City on that continuing flight, I had outlined done the outline for my book, The Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism. But essentially what she pointed out to me, it's one of these obvious things, but she says, take your body. Each of our bodies is comprised of tens of trillions of individual living cells. Each one is making continuous decisions in the process of exchanging nutrients, water, energy, and information. And the outcome of those exchanges is the human body that is the vessel of our consciousness and the agency of our engagement. You know, that's, you know, once you hear it expressed, you think about it and you realize, yes, that's obviously true. The implications are humongous, particularly for someone like me. My academic field is organization, you know, how do humans organize, and of course, was originally introduced to it in terms of how do we organize as corporations to maximize profits. But If you think about that, how would you go about organizing if tens of trillions of individual living cells, all with a common objective to create and maintain this organism we call a human being, that has this extraordinary capacity for intelligence, imagination, creativity, and action to change the future of the planet. Wow. That's quite extraordinary.
Well, exactly. And this is what Bruce Lipton was talking about as well, that if we look at the patterns of evolution, always involve two things, greater connection, i.e. community, and greater awareness. And so this next phase of human evolution is recognizing that we are indeed all cells in a larger superorganism called humanity, and so much of what we've been doing is autoimmune dysfunction.
Yeah. This is why it seems to me that rather than focusing on quantum physics, in a sense trying to push our understanding of the physical world, that the more immediate issue is understanding ourselves as living beings, and part of the process by which living beings self-organize. And the significance of that comes in when you realize that, you know, what's happening in our body between our cells is very parallel to what is happening on Earth in the interactions between all of the different living species, the amoebas, the microorganisms, the plant life, and the animal life, and then ultimately humans that are part of the animal kingdom in a way, but have this extraordinary conceptual capacity as well as physical capacities that are totally unlike any other animal that we are aware of. But I, you know, my own sense is that we need to be focusing more at this point, at least, on the biological framing rather than the physics. That to me is where the breakthrough comes in our understanding that, you know, once we grasp the interdependence of the cells in our body, we can begin to grasp the interdependence of all the living beings on Earth and why it is so important that we learn to live in ways which are supportive of the well-being of Earth as a living being, so that we're able to all survive and evolve together. And that, that basically is the, you know, the shift in perception that is, you know, you sometimes refer to trim tabs, which suggest a little minor adjustment, and in a sense, it's a minor adjustment in our mental frame, but it is ultimately the trim tab that if we get that in our mind and are able to separate ourselves from the frameworks of conventional physics and the frameworks of conventional economics, which would have us believe that we're financial beings and we are, you know, the more money humanity has, the better off we are, which again is sheer nonsense. It's just a number that's useless. Our banks can create as much of it as we need. That should not be our issue. The issue is how do we use our physical resources, the financial resources that are simply an institutional figment of our imagination, but in order to live in a way that maximizes the health and well-being of the living Earth, which then can better meet our needs in ways that allow us to actualize the deepest potentials of our humanity.
You know, one of the terms that you brought up in a recent piece that I read of yours is, you know, you're talking about map making, and who makes the maps, and what are the maps that determine the pathways of our thinking? And again, these ideas that you're presenting, you know, some people know them, but they have not really made it into the mainstream narrative. You know, as another example of biology, very few people know that there's far, far, far more microorganisms living in our bodies than there are human cells, and that these microorganisms, yes, it turns out, is what help us digest our food, help us remove our waste, help us metabolize, and so on. And here we are involved in this COVID thing, where once again, like so many of the Newtonian approaches to our world, we have a war on these microbes. We're at war with them. We want to destroy them, rather than recognizing that this is there is a harmony that we need to establish. And I think that one of the, I would call it the elephant and the donkey in the living room, because really it's bigger than either our political parties, right? It
yes,
has to do with how these narratives, how do you break through the soundless barrier? How do you break this new narrative through the narratives that are controlled by those who already have the power and wealth? How do you create new narratives that actually can take hold? Or is this already happening and we may not know it?
Well, it is happening. Now, it's also interesting. The important thing here is, first of all, recognizing that the barrier is in our mind. And the human mind has the potential to shift very quickly. You know, within our own experience, you may recall the experiences with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of apartheid in South Africa. Mm-hmm. If you remember back to those, both of them happened almost in an instant, at least in terms of our understanding from the distance we were viewing them. If days before you were asked, you think there's a possibility that the Soviet Union might be falling apart, you say, well, that's ridiculous. And then suddenly it just happened. And those are examples of a mental shift. We could go back further in terms of the fall of British colonial rule in India, which also happened quite quickly. Now, those are examples of the kind of shift that can take place. Now, what's actually happened as a result in the Soviet Union and in South Africa is far from what we might think of as the ideal, partly because the forces that pushed the shift were mainly focused on what people didn't want and were not willing to contend with anymore. Mm-hmm. But had very little perception of what is it that we truly seek. And that's why the kind of conversation we're having right here is so important. And the thing that gives me hope is my sense that there is a readiness for this kind of conversation that we've never experienced before. And that we as members of civil society, we don't have the kind of control of media that the far right has. but we do have many outlets. And, of course, the key to this is not, you know, who is the guru, who has the answer. The process is inherently and essentially collective. It is the community. We will only get to where we need to go through community action of people working together, learning together at all levels of society, every place in the world, but all with a kind of common sense of, well, yes, ultimately we are interconnected. And either we are going to expire together out of our errors, our arrogance, our egotism, our individuality, or we are going to recognize that life depends on the cooperative interaction of the whole, and that applies to humans also. And that my well-being depends on your well-being, and our common interest is the well-being of all.
Yeah, this is a real revolution. My friend and colleague Joseph McCormick, who is a conservative, transpartisan thinker and activist, talked about the evolution of revolution. And you know, of course, used to be revolution was there was a strong leader, whether that was George Washington or whoever. That led a group of people. And then in the 20th century, the revolutionaries became people with more of a moral and spiritual foundation, like Nelson Mandela, like Martin Luther King, like Gandhi. And now the evolution of revolution is getting to the point where it's the collective, it's our we the people, our sane and sacred center, our coherent voice, that together, we are the leaders that we have been waiting for. We're going to take a short break. I've got a couple of other questions about very healthy, I think, memes that we can circulate. We'll be back after this message with David Courtney.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
We're back with our guest, David Courtney, today. And I, in your work, I came across two really, I think, promising ideas and memes that, you know, might be able to capture the imagination of people to lead us into this pathway that you've been talking about. One is called Ubuntu, which came out of Africa. I have always found this to be a very, very positive and heartening notion. Tell us about Ubuntu and what the implications are.
Yeah, Ubuntu in its simple translation, and this, you know, this comes out of the the deepest traditional wisdom, and it's fascinating coming out of Africa because basically, so far as we know, all of us humans came out of Africa. That is the motherland. But the simple translation is, I am because you are. Or in a larger sense, I am because we are.
Mm-hmm.
And within that deeper sense, it is both, you know, both human and the whole of nature. In a sense, I am because life is.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, we've got so many complicated situations in Africa, but if you go back to, there are many of the people still basically live and organize around this deeper philosophy. Now, another thing that's coming out as I'm engaged in conversations about this Ubuntu framework and what I'm suggesting we might call the Ubuntu principle, which is that my well-being depends on your well-being, so we need to work together, is that at the deeper understanding of the framing is the relationship between the individual and the whole, the community. And kind of how I'm thinking about it now is we have gone so astray as Western civilization on the individualism. It's all about me. The neoliberal ideology that there is no community, the Margaret Thatcher ideology. It's just individuals. So we maximize our individual well-being, and that's then everybody's going to be fine. In terms of my early experiences in Asia, and I've lived in Southeast Asia for 21 years. My early exposures to Asia before the Western impact on the culture, it was just an extraordinary sense of people identifying not as individuals, but as the group, as the collective. It was almost a suppression of the individual. And as I'm coming to understand the deeper framing of the traditional African framework, it recognizes the place of both the group and the individual, that the creativity of the group depends on the creativity of the individuals, but individuals acting as members of the group. So it's not a kind of suppression of the individual, but it's a balancing of the individual and the collective. And I think that's the kind of deeper meaning that we need to come to here. These are kind of at the forefront of the current conversation as we begin to understand ourselves, particularly within the frame of understanding what does it mean to be human, and recognizing that as human beings we have distinctive capabilities that we have for a long time, particularly in Western society, thought of as bringing us special privileges, including the privilege and the right to destroy nature and basically to enslave our fellow humans. But coming to a deeper understanding that these special capabilities that we have as humans are both our special physical and mental capabilities confer unusual responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole different kind of framework. So from, this is I think, a fundamental shift from, all the focus on what are our human rights, but recognition that there basically are, you know, within this larger frame of understanding, there are no rights without responsibilities. So the rights and responsibilities need to be balanced. And again, it's one of these things that I think is obvious for any, you know, psychologically healthy human. It's just we've got to learn to embrace them and to apply them.
The original religion comes, as you know, from the word from religare, which is to bind. It's sort of the same root as ligament, and the idea behind the concept of religion is something that binds us to the web of life, to the web of love, to the ineffable, to our fellow human beings. And that, you know, that's the original, let's call it a positive vibration of religion. And because of, you know, the corruption of human institutions, you know, we've been left with, you know, like the joke, spirituality is our connection to the divine and religion is crowd control. So, so in getting to this, you know, this idea of Ubuntu, are people who are naturally feel that connection with other people, and then there are other people who have so much cynicism about human institutions and the tyranny of the collective, and the people on the right who voted for Donald Trump, rather than characterize them as deplorables, I would prefer to see them as people who recognize, that they were concerned that their individual liberties and the things that make us human, like, for example, our right to privacy and all of these things, were being destroyed by this neoliberal order, and also by this growing technocracy, where artificial intelligence is set to supersede real intelligence. And so I think that that part of this rehumanization process involves finding ways to recognize that that impulse in just about every human being who's not a sociopath, the impulse for that connection. You put it really well about, what makes us human? I forget the exact phrase, but it really had to do with honoring these relationships and connections, and that the people who are happiest in the world are the ones who have cultivated these kinds of relationships, and it transcends political ideology.
Yeah, exactly. You know, another thing on the from the more conservative side is the concern for local control. If you separate that from the individualism, it's absolutely right that this is part of the marvel of understanding life and how it organizes. It is everywhere local. You know, in terms of the body's organization, it's not about a central dictator. It's about all of these cells intuiting and somehow understanding and making decisions at the very most local level of our bodies that all comes together to create the whole. And you translate that into our understanding of how we have to live as humans in relation to Earth. I mentioned my wife and her little garden plot. Part of managing that plot is recognizing, where does the water flow? Where does the sunshine hit? So even within that, what is basically a tiny plot of garden land, adjusting where you put the seeds and the plants and the trellis and all these things in relation to this very micro level of adaptation. And you begin to look at how we organize as humans, and you recognize, some people live in the edge of desert, some live in the tropical jungle, some are in the Arctic regions. every place where we live, we need to adapt within the framework of our local connections, making those decisions in ways that can only be made locally and basically individually, but within a framework of our sense of interdependence, and that all of the local pieces ultimately have to fit together if we're to have a healthy earth. It's truly extraordinary when you begin to think of it. So the tendency on progressives is to centralize and concentrate power to make sure that everybody is being responsible and taken care of at the local level. But basically what we have to recognize as the goal and responsibility of more central governments is their role in securing local control within a larger framework of cooperation, so that each people has the control of its own resources, rather than our current situation where most of our local resources are controlled by global corporations, ultimately accountable to global financial markets, but returning that power to the local so that we can live in relationship to our place on Earth.
One of the things that you bring up, and I'm going to handle this, this is really a key point, that has to do with that balance, that local balance, and also the balance between the individual and the collective, is what the British economist Kate Raworth calls the donut economy. And I saw your very brief explanation of the donut economy, and I found it so elegant that I'd like for you to share that. I think it really holds a promising piece to where we need to go.
Yeah, it's a whole lot easier to describe with a graphic, but you get the image of a donut in your mind.
Yeah.
And what she points out is that we have to learn to live within the space internal to the donut. Now, on the outer edge, she has our relationship to Earth, and that basically we need to meet our needs within the donut in ways that maintain the health of the world's water systems, land systems, atmosphere, and so forth. And at the same time, the inner circle of the donut is essentially relates to our meeting of our fundamental human needs, so to make sure that all people fall within the physical area of the donut in terms of meeting their needs for food, for clean air, for clean water, social equality and justice, a place to live, a voice in decision making, adequate education, and so forth. So basically, we have to learn to meet our fundamental human needs in ways that maintain the necessary balance with the Earth. And her donut framing, I think, is one of the very best that that anybody has yet come up with.
Yeah, of course, a lot of people are living right there in the hole, right in the middle there, where there's nothing.
But yeah, exactly. Far too many people in the hole of the donut.
Far too many people have fallen into the hole. And it really is a very simple balance. But, of course, as you know, as you point out elsewhere in your work, you know, one of the ways that the current system has thrown things out of balance is because so many of the costs of what we're doing have been externalized, and responsibility has been externalized, and it's all been sent to the future. And so,
yes.
You know, as we're winding down our little interview here, what is it that you see, given the what we call the situation that we face right now? How, you know, what do you see right now as the pathways toward an adjacent possible to things that we can start doing right now that might trip that what you talked about earlier, which is the all of a sudden rapid change, like being the overnight success after 25 years. What are some of the things you're seeing on the horizon right now that you're that are promising toward actually bringing this about?
It is people working together. We, for too long, framed this as, well, if you're concerned about the environment, you know, get yourself an electric car and you know, go vegan and so forth. It's all just a matter of your individual choices. The fact is, it's not just your individual choices, because the way society organizes it makes it very difficult for us to live in environmental balance. For example, in terms of the issue of electric cars, you know, it's not a matter of shifting to electric cars. It's a matter of moving away from our dependence on cars, which, again, if you know, having lived in New York City, is a place mm-hmm. where, at least when I lived there, that you had to be an idiot to have a car. You don't need it, and you begin to see how, you know, everything that you need is basically in your neighborhood. If you need to go to somebody else's neighborhood, you get on the subway. and this is, you know, we need to be organizing as communities, the same things that we're doing in these international discussions with people who we're rethinking the whole structure of how our institutions need to come together and our conceptual framing of ourselves and our relationships with Earth.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, David Corden. We're definitely to relocalize the conversation in order for us to survive globally. Thanks so much for being with us on WikiPolitiki. David Corden, it's been a pleasure.
Been great. Thank you.